Ekhatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really big topic, I think one of the most crucial for understanding the world today, the history of modern China. You know, we often hear this narrative, this simple story of a sudden economic giant just emerging in the last, what, 40 years.
Right. But that straight line story, it just misses so much, doesn't it? We're diving into Rana Mitter's fantastic guide, Modern China, a very short introduction precisely to, well, complicate that picture.
Okay.
Our goal here is to show you that China's journey wasn't smooth at all. It was incredibly turbulent, often violent, really a continuous state of revolution, a century-long, relentless search for a new identity after its whole ancient political world just sort of fell apart.
Yeah. And what really hit me reading Mitter is his central point. If you want to understand what China does today, you know, it's assertive foreign policy, the state controlling the economy, that kind of ideological tightness, you absolutely have to grasp this history, this historical trauma.
Exactly.
He basically argues that every major policy choice now is in some way a result of that struggle, that deep fear of going back to the chaos of the past.
That's really the core insight. And before we jump right into the thick of the history, maybe we should quickly say who's guiding us here. Rana Mitter.
Right. He's the professor of the history and politics of modern China at Oxford.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's globally seen as a leading, maybe the leading Western authority on this.
And I think what makes his view so valuable isn't just that he's summarizing Western research. He digs deep into Chinese language sources, actual primary materials.
Which is crucial.
Yeah, and he approaches this incredibly complex, often brutal history with real intellectual honesty and, I'd say, empathy. He's not just pointing fingers.
No, definitely not. He's particularly strong on the 20th century, isn't he? That whole messy Republican era. And he really pushes back against what he calls deterministic narratives.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he refuses to write history as if the communist victory in 1949 was somehow bound to happen. He focuses much more on the choices people made, the turning points, how things could have gone differently.
Absolutely. Contingency is key for him. And, you know, if you want proof of his influence, just look at his earlier book, Forgotten Alley, China's World War II.
Oh, huge book.
Totally changed how we in the West understood China's role in that war. It was absolutely massive, China's contribution, but often just overlooked. And Mitter shows how that whole wartime experience shaped everything that came after.
Okay, so let's get to the main argument of this short introduction.
Yeah.
The big idea. Modern China's story is one of continuous revolution.
Continuous revolution. Yeah, not just like one big event in 1911 when the emperor fell or 1949 with the communists taking over. It was this ongoing upheaval affecting everything, politics, society, culture, identity, all driven by the need to find something stable to replace that collapsed imperial system.
So the book is kind of an interpretive map.
Yeah.
It guides you from the internal crumbling of the Qing Empire back in the mid-19th century.
And also the impact of foreign imperialism. You can't ignore that.
Right. Through the chaos of the warlord era, that intense fight between the nationalists, the KMT, and the communists, the CCP.
And then it moves into the really devastating parts. The war with Japan, which is just catastrophic, then the civil war that followed, and then under Mao, this period of radical communist social engineering.
Yeah, the utopian dream turning violent. Things like the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, just immense suffering.
And Mitter argues all of this leads directly to the China we see now. After Mao, Deng Xiaoping brings in reform and opening up this huge pragmatic shift.
Massive economic change.
Unbelievable economic growth, yeah. But, and this is a crucial point, it's combined with an increasingly authoritarian single-party political system. That tension, that fundamental contradiction between wealth and political rigidity,
yeah,
that's modern China in a nutshell, according to Mitter.
That tension is so central.
Mm-hmm.
And to really get how it emerged, Mitter makes a step back. He asks, you know, what did modernity even mean for a civilization that had just lost its 2,000-year-old political structure?
Right. It wasn't just about copying the West. He insists it was this incredibly painful, internally driven response to this huge void that opened up.
And it's interesting because often the story focuses on Western powers bullying China. But Mitter says, hang on, the internal problems were just as important, maybe more so, in the Qing dynasty's collapse.
Absolutely. He talks about systemic issues. Bureaucracy that couldn't change, massive corruption, population pressures, the state just couldn't cope.
And that internal weakness, it was brutally exposed by the Taiping Rebellion. That's mid-19th century, 1850 to 64.
Yeah, this wasn't a small thing. It was a huge civil war led by this kind of messianic figure. And the numbers are just mind-boggling. Tens of millions
Yes,
killed.
tens of
I
millions.
mean, that fact alone tells you something profound. Mitter argues it's basically proof the empire had lost the mandate of heaven, that traditional legitimacy.
So the final collapse comes in 1911. And that leads into the warlord era, right?
Hey.
Where China just fragments, no real central control.
Total chaos. But amidst that political mess, you get this really deep cultural shift, the May 4th movement in 1919.
Ah, yes. Hugely important.
It was this nationwide intellectual and cultural explosion, a rejection, really, of traditional Confucian culture, looking instead towards new radical ideas imported from the West, things like science, democracy, socialism.
And that ferment, that intellectual chaos, kind of sets the stage for the big ideological battle to come between the KMT, the nationalists,
Under Chiang Kai-shek.
right, and the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, which eventually brings Mao Zedong to the forefront.
So let's look at the KMT's shot at unifying things. Chiang Kai-shek's government, the Nanjing Decade, that's roughly 1927 to 1937.
They did achieve some things, didn't they? Building infrastructure, a national currency, trying to modernize.
They did. There were successes. But Mitter really highlights the flaws, big ones. Corruption was rampant. And crucially, they failed on land reform. They just didn't connect with the massive rural population, the peasants.
And that failure, that was the opening for Mao Zedong, wasn't it?
Exactly. Mao and the communists had been basically driven out of the cities by the KMT. So Mao develops this completely different strategy, focused on the countryside, on the peasants, building support by promising land, equality, essentially creating a rival state out in the rural areas.
Okay, so you had these two forces vying for control. But if Mitter points to one single event that really shaped the outcome, it's the war with Japan, right? The Second Sino-Japanese War, 1937 to 45.
Absolutely. He calls it the crucible. It was devastating for China, but it fundamentally shifted the balance between the KMT and the CCP.
How?
Well, the KMT, the nationalists, they did the bulk of the conventional fighting against Japan. They lost their main bases in the cities, their armies were ground down, their government became even more corrupt, inflation went through the roof, they lost popular support.
Well, the CCP.
The CCP used guerrilla tactics, mostly in the countryside. They expanded their territory, built up their forces, and critically, they managed to portray themselves as the real patriots, the ones truly fighting the Japanese invaders effectively, even if on a smaller scale initially.
So the war just bled the nationalists dry, basically.
Fatally weakened them. So when the full-scale civil war picks up again right after Japan surrenders in 1945, the communists are disciplined, they have widespread peasant support, and they just prove to be militarily superior.
Which leads to the founding of the People's Republic of China in 49. And
Yeah.
then comes Mao's era in full force.
Yeah, and this is where the utopianism turns truly dark. You have the Great Leap Forward starting around 1958, Mao's attempt to rapidly industrialize overnight.
It leads to the worst famine in human history,
Yeah.
completely man-made.
It's just a horrific catastrophe. And then, as if that wasn't enough, you get the Cultural Revolution starting in 66, this violent decade-long upheaval aimed at destroying old traditions, old thoughts, creating this new socialist man through, well, through brutal purges and chaos.
It's just staggering waves of violence and disruption. But then, after Mao dies, comes this incredible pivot under Deng Xiaoping, the policy of reform and opening up.
One of the most dramatic shifts you'll see anywhere in modern history, pragmatism takes over, unleashing the economy, allowing market forces huge success in terms of growth.
But this is the key. Mia Kamitar keeps returning to. The politics didn't open up. The party kept its absolute grip on power. And the moment that really cemented this deal, this implicit contract, was Tiananmen Square in 1989.
Right. The student protests demanding political reform were crushed violently.
And the message was clear.
Unmistakably clear. Economic progress, yes. Political challenge to the party, absolutely not. And that brutal suppression, followed by decades of incredible economic growth, really set the terms for China ever since.
Okay, so drilling down into the big takeaways Mitter wants us to grasp, the first one feels absolutely central. The overwhelming importance placed on a strong, unifying state.
Yeah, this deep, deep fear of chaos. The Chinese word is luan. It's baked into the political psyche. It comes directly from that memory of the empire collapsing, the warlord era, just fragmentation and suffering.
So every regime since then, KMT, Mao, Deng, and Xi Jinping today, Their primary goal, arguably, is maintaining central control, maintaining stability, even if it means sacrificing individual freedoms. The fear of Luan trumps pretty much everything else.
It really does. But then the second point is kind of a counterpoint to all that revolutionary change. Mitter stresses the historical continuity.
Right. Even with these radical shifts, empire to republic to communism, certain core ideas persist, like that need for central authority, the emphasis on stability, the state having a huge role in the economy.
Exactly. China borrows and adapts from the outside, but it's always selective. It's modernization on its own terms, not just becoming a copy of the West. Deep continuities remain.
Okay, third theme.
The trauma of national weakness. That period from roughly the Opium Wars in 1839 up to 1949 is often called the Century of Humiliation.
Yeah, carved up by foreign powers, invaded by Japan.
It's a living memory, constantly invoked by the party. And this feeling of having been weak and victimized fuels this intense desire for strength, for sovereignty, for respect on the world stage. You see it driving so much of China's foreign policy and nationalism today. It's an obsession, really.
And the last major theme you flagged.
The urban-rural divide. This huge gap between the modern, often wealthy, cosmopolitan cities and the vast, much poorer countryside. This isn't new. It shaped everything in the 20th century.
It explains partly why the KMT, more urban-based, failed, and the CCP, with its peasant strategy, succeeded.
Precisely. And that divide, that inequality, it's still a massive challenge for China today.
Yeah.
Huge economic disparities between regions.
Mitter really does have a way of boiling down this incredibly complex history into, like, really powerful, punchy insights.
He does. Some of his lines just stick with you.
I was struck by how he described the fall of the Qing dynasty. He says, the fall of the Qing Empire in 1911 was not just the end of a dynasty, but the collapse of a 2,000-year-old political and cultural universe.
Yeah, that really conveys the scale of it, doesn't it? It wasn't just a change of management. The whole framework of meaning collapsed, an existential crisis.
Totally. And then, jumping forward, you have Deng Xiaoping's famous pragmatism after all the Maoist ideology. The quote everyone knows, "It doesn't matter if a cat is black or white, as long as it catches mice."
Perfect illustration of the shift, right? Forget ideology, just focus on what works, on delivering economic results, get people fed, get the country richer.
And then there's the quote, or maybe it's more of a core idea, capturing the post-Tiananmen reality. The bargain offered to the Chinese people after the Tiananmen crackdown of 1989 was clear. You can get rich, but you cannot challenge the party.
That really nails the fundamental social contract, doesn't it? It's often unspoken, but that's basically the deal that has held, more or less, for the last 30-plus years.
And one more, which kind of forces you to think differently. China is not just another country. It is a civilization pretending to be a nation-state.
Ooh, that's a powerful one. A reminder that applying standard Western political science models might not quite capture the reality of a place with such a distinct, long history and sense of self. It sees itself differently.
Okay, so let's make this practical. If you're listening, how does knowing all this history actually help you understand what's happening now? Maybe let's start with business and economics.
Right. If you're involved in the Chinese market or thinking about it, Mitter's history underlines one absolutely critical point.
Mm-hmm.
The party comes first, always.
Political control over economic logic.
Pretty much. Political considerations will often override purely economic ones. That's why you see the state cracking down on hugely successful private companies like Alibaba, for example.
Even if it spooks investors or seems economically counterproductive in the short term.
Exactly. Because if the party perceives a company or an individual becoming too powerful, too independent, potentially challenging its authority, it will act. The fear of losing control, that fear of Luan, is greater than the fear of a temporary economic dip.
Okay, and what about understanding geopolitics and current events? Things like Hong Kong or Xi Jinping's tightening grip.
Well, Mitter's perspective suggests these aren't just random power grabs or, you know, isolated acts of authoritarianism. They flow directly from that core CCP ideology, that foundational fear of fragmentation.
It's about maintaining unity and control at all costs.
Yes. From the party's perspective, things like the Hong Kong protests or any sign of regional dissent or ideological deviation, these are existential threats. They echo that historical chaos they are desperate to avoid. So the response is often swift and harsh, aimed at ensuring total unified national control. It's about preventing history from repeating itself as they see it.
So wrapping up, final thoughts from this deep dive. What really stayed with you?
for me, it's that core contradiction we talked about, this incredibly dynamic, almost hyper-capitalist economy bolted onto this increasingly rigid Leninist political system. Mitter shows how this tension is the direct result of China's revolutionary century. But the key thing is it's unresolved. The revolution, the transformation, it isn't really over. And that makes China's future path genuinely uncertain, I think. That tension has to resolve somehow, eventually.
Yeah, that's a great point. For me, the biggest takeaway was that shift in perspective. Getting past the easy stereotypes, you know, communist threat or economic miracle, and really appreciating China as this vast ancient civilization that's been through immense trauma in the last century and a half, but also shown incredible resilience. Understanding that deep history, the struggle for identity, the fear of chaos. It doesn't mean agreeing with the government's actions, obviously, but it demands a more nuanced, maybe even empathetic view if we actually want to understand why China acts the way it does today. It's complicated. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.